Agnomata with me for fear its power would reveal it. So I reopened the secret vaults within the gene labs of Herodotus Omega, vaults that were rightly condemned and long ago sealed. I hid the Magnamata deep and wove unbreakable seals about them while I slumbered.
Let me guess, said Tyro. Those seals weren't as unbreakable as you thought.
Even on Luna, it seems the rot of treachery runs deep, said Talab Vita 37 sadly. As I regenerated, building the strength to continue my duty, enemy hunters learned of my lone vigil and tracked me to my refuge. Corrupted cybernetics almost took me, but they underestimated the power of a gene maiden, even an old and frail one. I unmade them and fled into the Silver Oceans, using the old ways to send a message of desperation into the void.
And we have answered your call. So what would you have us do? Said Branthon.
Talab Vita 37 aimed her staff in the direction of the volcano.
Time is short, she said. Renegade Martian tech priests are using a degenerative viral sentience to undo the gene seals I placed upon the vaults within Herodotus Omega.
How long do we have before they break in? Asked Tyro.
5 of the seals have already succumbed. The 6th is almost gone, and it is only a matter of time until the 7th seal is no more, and the Sons of Horus will be within.
If the Sons of Horus hold the main entrance, how do we get inside? Asked Tyro.
Main entrance,
cackled Talab Vita 37.
Your kind is always so literal.
Leaving Wayland and Thematica to try to get the Storm Eagle airborne, Talab Vita 37 led the others deeper into the canyon. Sharukin gripped Wayland's arm as he left. The Iron Father's face was pale, but he gave no sign of any pain from the leg he had lost in the crash. He had already bound a broken stanchion to the severed stump to act as a crutch, using cable and insulation material pulled from the torn fuselage.
Be safe, brother,
said Wayland. You too, brother, said Sharukin, unable to shake a feeling of grim premonition.
I'll have this flying before you get back. Mark my words.
Sharukin had seen aircraft in worse states keep flying, but not for long, and few of them ever got back in the air once they were down. I don't doubt it, he said. That farewell had been 2 hours and 15 kilometers ago. Sharukin scouted ahead of the others as they pushed along the canyon towards the unfinished venting station built into the haunches of the volcano. Dust fragments drifted down like ashen rain into the canyon, as well as larger pieces of fused metal smashed from orbit. Sharukin had passed a number of bodies too, but hadn't stopped to examine them. Occasional flashes of secondary detonations in orbit, or the streaks of burning debris carving a fiery line across the sky, briefly illuminated the canyon floor. 10 meters behind, Ignatius Newman swept the ground before him with his Volkite. The veteran had fought with Sharukin long enough to know the Raven Guard warrior was in no danger from any shots he might fire. Atesh Tarsa and Branthon flanked Talab Vita 37, while Cadmus Tyro provided rear security. Garuda circled above him, keeping below the lip of the canyon. It irked Sharukin that the bird was keeping pace with him, but the bird went where it wanted, and nothing anyone could do or say to it made any difference. Sharukin moved silently, his steps lighter than air, barely disturbing the dust and leaving no mark of his passing. Moving this way was instinctual to him. The darkness in the canyon was deep and comforting, even if he didn't know this world's shadows. Their nuances were unknown to him, but they welcomed him nonetheless. To those not trained by the Shadow Masters, all such umbra were alike. But Sharukin knew better. He had been born to the shadows, and they had raised him, nurtured him, and taught him, like a child raised by beasts in a forest. He knew their ways, and they his. Talab Vita 37 had told him to look for a section of canyon wall with 3 teardrop-shaped impact craters in a pattern resembling an elongated spear tip aimed at the dead volcano. Sharukin's eyes were in constant motion, but he had seen nothing resembling such a formation, and they were getting dangerously close to the enemy Auspex net his passive auto-senses were detecting. 300 meters later, he halted, as a bloom of light from an explosion threw the eastern wall into sharp relief. And there they were. 3 impact craters, the result of meteors having struck the canyon wall at the precise angle to form a spear tip, the pattern entirely natural, yet completely distinct. Sharokin stepped from the shadows, an act that would tell Newman they had reached their destination. He hunted for any sign of something man-made, but could see nothing special about this location. A sliver of the volcano's summit was just visible between the narrow walls and through the veil of drifting fragments. Talab Vita 37 and the others approached, and Sharokin indicated the impact craters in the wall.
"You have good eyes,"
Talab Vita 37 said. "You should know," said Sharokin. "Your kind enhanced them."
"That we did, Raven Guard. Irreducible complexity be damned," she replied.
"So why are we here? What do these marks signify?"
"That we have our way in,"
said Talab Vita 37.
"Where?"
demanded Branthon.
"There is nothing here."
"If there's a way in here, it's well hidden," said Sharokin.
"Your eyes are keen, but you don't see everything, Raven,"
said Talab Vita 37. The Gene Witch approached the dark rock of the canyon wall and set her staff of charms and cables against it. More lights flickered beneath the surface of her helm, and previously invisible seams opened in the rock. Seams Sharokin knew with absolute certainty that no Shadow Master or High Fabricatus of the Mechanicum would ever have found.
200 years I have travelled the moon, beyond sight and out of mind,"
said Talab Vita 37.
"Do you really think I don't know all her secret ways?"
The cavern within the canyon wall was rough-hewn, its walls curved and scored with napped patterns that made Sharokin feel as if he stood within some giant sea creature's shell. He ran his finger along the inner walls, feeling repetition in the patterns, as if the rock had been dug by the rhythmic gestures of something desperate to claw its way out. That impression was only reinforced by the sight of an exposed sheet of metal on the far wall of the cave, a portion of ductwork revealed by excavations into the rock. A ragged hole had been cut into the metal from within by what looked like a thermal lance, and the portion excised from the duct lay on the ground. "What is this?" Sharokin asked.
"A segment of venting ductwork that leads from inside and eventually comes out high on the flanks of the volcano,"
said Talab Vita 37. "This our way in?"
"Yes."
Sharokin leaned cautiously into the duct, feeling the passage of warm, ionized air drifting from somewhere deep inside the mountain. "This leads to the vaults."
"It does,"
confirmed Talab Vita 37.
"To a sealed storage facility."
"Wait,"
said Atash Tarsa, kneeling by the edge of the hole cut in the duct and consulting the readout on his Narthesium.
"What are these pipes venting? What machinery is this ducting connected to?"
"This ductwork is part of the radiation filtration system," said Talab Vita 37.
"Radiation," said Tyro. "How bad is it, Tarsa?"
"The levels are below lethal, but still significant," said Tarsa.
"A radiation filter," said Tyro. "Why do you need a radiation filtration system that requires ducting of this size? Didn't you say there were gene labs in here?"
"This facility was built upon one of the original Koenig Alpha atomic waste sites."
"What? Why would you build a gene lab on an atomic waste site?"
"The containment systems were more than adequate to render the internal environment sterile,"
said Talab Vita 37.
"But the proximity to a waste site would convince anyone who thought to look this way that no work of any import could possibly be carried out here."
"What work was being carried out here?" asked Tyro.
Talab Vita 37 hesitated before answering.
"Highly secret research that was intended to become a new branch of Legion genetics, but which was abandoned when it only produced freaks and monsters. We destroyed them, and this place was shut down long ago."
"And this is where you hid the Magna Mater?" asked Tyro.
"Yes. It is a place of forgotten echoes now."
"Well, that doesn't sound ominous at all," said Sharukin. Chapter 7. No more to give. Infiltration. Too late. Wayland leaned back in his pilot's seat and gritted his teeth against the pain. It raced around his body in rivers of fire from his severed leg, suffusing every fibre of his being with almost paralysing agony. His armour had long since exhausted its supply of balms in the years since Istvan V, but not all the pain he was feeling was his own. Thick cables ran from his gauntlet into an exposed conduit of wires he'd unscrewed from the interior of the Storm Eagle's fuselage. He felt the agony of the machine spirit at the heart of the gunship, its fury and its torment at being grounded. It overwhelmed his pain, for it was the pain of desire broken on the wheel of reality. Wayland whispered the binaric catechisms of repair and restoration to soothe its broken spirit. The machine's pain was hideous, and he felt its wounded soul on the verge of dissipating into the ether. He reached for it, but it turned at bay, screeds of binary lashing out at him. The connection between the gunship and Wayland was abruptly severed with a screeching roar of fury from the Vox, and Wayland's eyes snapped open, his skin lathered in icy sweat. He disconnected from the avionics panel, his movements clumsy with pain and residual echoes of his conjoined consciousness. He pulled himself from the pilot's seat and limped back to the troop compartment. Freighter Thematica knelt by the dormant form of the demersal splicer Talab Vita 37 had brought down. Its appearance bore few hallmarks of Imperial craft, and its grotesque cephalopodic body possessed a more organic form than Wayland was used to seeing. Ever the tinkerer, Thematica had the mechanized arms of his servo harness prodding circuitry within an access panel he'd prized open. The Iron Father usually preferred to work manually, but such was the scale of repairs needed to render the Storm Eagle flyable that he had been forced to dig a servo harness from its stowage bay. The welder tips on its fusion torch arms still glowed red with heat.
"What are you doing with that?" asked Wayland.
"Investigating," said Thematica without looking up. "I've never seen technology like this before. It would be a shame not to at least take a look at it. The MIU links are extraordinary, verging on the edge of true machine autonomy. Given free rein, this could fly a fleet of gunships on its own. If I can just disengage these inhibitors, I could link it with..."
"The Storm Eagle," interrupted Wayland. "Walk me through it."
Now Thematica looked up, and the multiple arms of the servo harness folded into their collapsed forms on his back.
"The fuselage was split in so many places I lost count, and a great many of the control surfaces are so badly damaged that it will be almost impossible to manoeuvre effectively. The landing gear is shattered, and the fuel tanks are all but empty."
"What's your prognosis? Is it fit to fly?"
Thematica said.
"I've sealed up all our wounds and realigned what I can, but without a Legion graving dock and a squadron of servitors, I fear this will be its final flight."
Wayland nodded and lowered himself into one of the compartment's armoured bucket seats. Pain from his leg was burning through his endurance, but he forced it into a sealed box in his mind. He was an Iron Hand. Pain was part of the journey. Birth to death, flesh to iron. Thematica put a hand on Wayland's shoulder and nodded to the cockpit.
"But nothing I can do to get us up in the air will matter if the machine spirit is broken."
"I can't reach it, Freighter," said Wayland. "The spirit recoils from my every entreaty like a wild animal in a snare, too consumed by rage and pain to understand I'm trying to help."
"No one has a way with the spirit of machines like you, Sabic," said Thematica. "I know you can reach it. You just need to be patient with it. And, all being well, we only need to be airborne long enough to return to the Sisyphium."
"All being well," snapped Wayland. "How well have things gone for us since Istvan V?
"Not like you to be defeatist, Sabic."
Wayland sighed.
"We all only have so much to give, Freighter."
Hot irradiated fumes and radioactive dust blew along the ductwork, in levels high enough to be deadly to a mortal, but harmless to the warriors of the legions. Talab Vita 37 led them through the twisting lengths of ducts. and it did not take long for them to reach the interior of the mountain. They emerged in a storage chamber, a cold space of angle-cut stone, stacked high with construction materiel that would never be used, broken machinery, and the accumulated detritus of abandoned spaces. A single trapezoidal archway led deeper into the mountain. Sharokin heard the distant sounds of shouting voices, mixed with the clang of metal on metal and the idling thrum of engines belonging to something heavy. A transport of some kind. A transorbital, at least. One by one, they moved into the chamber. Cadmus Tyro and Talab Vita 37 followed Sharokin, then Tarsa. Ignatius Newman came next, and finally Ulrak Branthon ducked down as he entered. Garuda clung to the metal at his shoulders.
"The vault is ahead," said Talab Vita 37.
"Should we expect to meet resistance?" asked Tyro.
"No,"
said Talab Vita 37.
"At least, not until we reach the vault chamber itself."
Despite the Gene Witch's assurances, the Space Marines moved off in perfect cover formation, each warrior protecting the other as they moved deeper into the mountain. The interior tunnels of the volcano were faced with pressed steel, and dust and silence hung heavy over them all. They moved from junction to junction, with Talab Vita 37 leading them unerringly onwards. At the arched entrance to an open chamber, they found barricades of collapsed gurneys and empty barrels stamped with biohazard markings. Blast burns, grenade shrapnel, and bullet impacts had chewed up the walls.
"What's in there?" asked Sharokin.
"The growth chambers," said Talab Beta 37, "where viable subjects were hothoused and matured in gene pods."
"The freaks and monsters?" Sharokin asked. "Is that all that's left here?"
"No,"
said Talab Vita 37.
"We purged all the monsters the Emperor couldn't use."
They passed through the smashed barricade and entered a vast chamber of dripping echoes and cold darkness. Long dead machinery gathered dust on the walls, rigging chains dangled from lifter cranes, and heavy-duty cabling lay inert on the floor amid shards of broken glass. Lined up in their thousands, like warriors at a legion muster, were row upon row of clear-fronted gene pods. Most were empty, but those that were not were filled with stagnant, milky residue, in which hulking forms could be glimpsed through the clouded glass. It was impossible to make out their exact nature, but Sharokin saw figures with transhuman bulk. But these were monstrous ogres, taller and broader than even the largest space marine. Sharokin kept pace with Talab Vita 37, and took a moment to study the Gene Witch.
"What is it you want to know?"
she asked, sensing his scrutiny.
"I'm not sure," he said. "It's not every day you get to meet one of your creators."
"Is that how you think of me?"
Sharokin shrugged. "Until we came to the moon, I had not thought of the Selenar much at all. You were a footnote to the early histories of the Drive from Terra. So little is known of you and your sect."
"Did you pause to wonder why that might be?"
"Not at all." Talab Vita 37 turned to face him, but her featureless helm gave no clue to her emotions.
"The Selenar have always existed in the cracks between perception," she said. "We have gone by many names and used many guises through the ages to move through the world of men. The Eleusinians, Osirika, the Damir, the Orcalata. The list goes on. But every name and every guise had but one purpose. Do you know what that was?"
"No," said Sharokin.
"To keep our power of creation out of the hands of men."
"Why?" Talab Vita 37 gave one of her wheezing laughs.
"Because we knew you would do what your kind always does with such a gift. You would seek to turn it into a weapon of conquest and dominance. And that's exactly what the Emperor did when he stole it from us all those years ago."
"Stole? My understanding was that Luna and Terra fought, yes, but that when the Emperor laid out his vision for the Imperium, the Selenar willingly joined forces to see it done." Talab Vita 37 shook her head, as though Sharokin had disappointed her.
"Of course that is your understanding. To accept that everything for which you fight is built on lies, murder, and theft,
does not fit the narrative you must craft in order to keep believing you are the heroes of this galaxy. Look at what has become of your Imperium, and tell me, we were not wise to keep such awesome power secret as long as we did.
There have been wars long before this one.
There have indeed, Ravengard. But wars waged by mortals burn out in mortal spans. They do not set the galaxy ablaze,
said Talib Vita 37, turning to wrap her over-articulated knuckles on his eagle-stamped plastron.
When gods make war, everyone burns in the fire with them.
Before Sharukin could reply, Talib Vita 37 bent double with a cry of pain. Sharukin immediately grabbed her and pulled her into cover, scanning for threats. He hadn't heard or sensed anything. The others followed his lead, finding machinery and structural elements to shelter behind. Talib Vita 37 clutched her gut, sinking to her knees. But for her staff, she would have fallen to the floor. Her body spasmed as though struck with a shock maul. "What's happening?" asked Sharukin. "Are you hurt?" Her chest hiked with rapid staccato breaths. Angry red spirals looped on the surface of her helmet.
"Ah, the seventh seal is broken," said Talib Vita 37. "The traitors are in the vault."
Thematica had done as much as he could with the tools and materials he had to make the Storm Eagle flyable. But even then, he wasn't sure it would be enough. So many elements of its structure were beyond battlefield repair, and the constant recycling and reuse of worn-out parts over the years had finally taken its inevitable toll. He felt reasonably confident it was structurally capable of getting airborne, but without a willing machine spirit, it likely wouldn't remain in the air for long. Without a machine spirit, a gunship was just tons of scrap metal. Thematica glanced along the troop compartment towards the cockpit, where Wayland again sought to coax the gunship's spirit back from the brink. Cables ran from his arm to the avionics panel, and pulsing communications passed back and forth between man and machine. Thematica had offered to help, but Wayland had shaken his head.
"No," he'd said. "I flew this gunship out of the fires of Istvan V. I flew it against Fulgrim's warriors and against those of Alpharius. Its spirit knows me. It trusts me. But it is wary of you."
Thematica couldn't blame it. Not really. The machine spirits of the Sisypheum gossiped with one another, passing secret machine knowledge in every binaric whisper. They knew Thematica as an experimenter. There's one who sought to change them. No, Wayland was right to decline his help. But this splicer, that was a different story entirely. It was a fascinating piece of technology. He'd exposed the length of its interior, and its workings were a marvel. Its roots were old, its components built from scratch, without recourse to anything Thematica recognized as an STC pattern. Its circuitry looked handmade, bespoke. The very thought of such a thing sent a thrill of excitement through him, and had given him an idea of how they might employ it, though Wayland had already decried it as too dangerous. Its control model was dizzyingly complex, an artificial neural web with heuristic capabilities that far outstripped what they'd seen inside Garuda when he and Wayland had stripped the bird down to repair it. Talib Vita 37 had said it was designed to take control of enemy aircraft in order to crash them or take control of vital systems. An ingenious and efficient way to turn an enemy's strength against them.
"Damnation!"
snapped Wayland from the cockpit.
"Still not responding?"
asked Thematica.
"No,"
said Wayland, sounding exhausted.
"It's all but given up."
The vault chamber had been carved deep into the southern haunches of the volcano, a rough circle a kilometre in diameter. It was filled with the actinic reek of burning metal and the molten heat of lascutters. Like every chamber they'd passed through, it was littered with derelict machinery, broken loader servitors and emptied stowage bins. Sharukin eased into cover behind a haphazardly stacked collection of metalled crates. Dust and fumes hung in the air in a thick fog, rendering the shapes moving through the space as blurred outlines. The entire caldera at the volcano's summit was peeled back, and the darkness of the void rippled through the energies of an integrity field. The light of stars beyond was indistinguishable from the winking lights of orbital detonations and falling debris. A bulky transorbital, without markings, squatted directly below the high entrance, its engines glowing with heat, spooling up in readiness for liftoff. A cadre of lifter servitors hauled dozens of bulky power cells on repulsor pallets up the embarkation ramp lowered beneath its aft section. Behind them, a multi-limbed tech priest supervised a group of glitching tech thralls in oil-stained canvas vac suits as they loaded steaming coolant cylinders into the transorbital stowage bays. At the center of the cavernous space was a deep circular shaft, putting Sharokin in mind of the Eldar crone world they'd followed Fulgrim and Perturabo to, and the depthless pit at its heart. Two dog-toothed silo doors, each 5 meters thick and 30 meters in length, were raised up on either side of the shaft. Noxious steam issued from below like clouds rising from some hideous underworld. The floor around the vault opening was littered with the bodies of servitors and dark-robed Lex mechanics. They were clearly dead, but their bodies jerked and twisted, purging vital fluids as the flesh rippled beneath the fabric of their robes like the surface of a restless ocean.
"What's happening to them?"
asked Newman, wrapping his fingers on the stock of his Volkite.
"The fail-safes on my gene locks are not kind to those who try to break them,"
said Talab Vita 37.
"What does that mean?"
Lights flickered across Talab Vita 37's helm in a pattern Sharokin had come to associate with grim amusement.
"Unsuccessful attempts to break my gene codes transfers a hyper-aggressive mutagen into the attacker that instantaneously and randomly sends their genetic order into chaos. Death is assured, and it is not painless."
Sharokin grinned in admiration. He counted at least 200 bodies, maybe more. However many it was, it hadn't been enough. "You underestimated the traitor's willingness to pay any price to breach your sanctum."
"Underestimating the depth of cruelty men possess has always been our problem," said Talab Vita 37.
"We can't linger here," said Atesh Tarsa, consulting his Narthesium and gesturing to the towering red silos lining the circumference of the cavernous space. "The rad levels are so high that even our armor won't keep us safe for long."
Each silo was banded with yellow and black hazard stripes and marked with an unmistakable radiation symbol. Sharokin was acutely reminded that this place had continued to serve as a repository of atomic waste deposited here in the moon's distant past.
"I thought you said this place was sterile,"
said Ulrak Branthon, crouched awkwardly in the shadow of a heavy tracked lifter rig.
"During this facility's years of operation it was," said Talab Vita 37. "But the filtration system has long since failed to scrub the atmosphere in any meaningful way, and this internal volume is thick with a broth of heavy metals and lethal isotopes."
"Then let's get this thing done," said Tyro, his fingers tightening on his bolter's grip.
"Wait," said Sharokin, as growing tremors shook the ground with a deep vibration. Orange hazard lights began flashing around the edge of the vault shaft as a heavy transit elevator ground its way up from somewhere deep below. The tech priest and his thralls watched in reverence as something came into view, its form obscured by reeking clouds of misty condensate. As the ammoniac clouds dispersed into the cold of the cavern, Sharokin's eyes grew wide at the sight of a monstrous servitor palanquin of flesh and metal. Wrought from the body of a hulking Migu, its frame had been augmented with steel-jacketed limbs, chemical shunts, and an MIU drive unit. Its back was artificially hunched, and brass steps had been implanted onto the meat and bone of its haunches. A tall and willow-thin Martian adept in red and black, his true form impossible to classify, but fringed with cabled limbs and surgical attachments, sat atop this grotesque palanquin on a chained harness. The Migu's body was rapidly devolving into a mass of pulsing lesions and unnatural growths, splitting and reforming between labored breaths. The consequence of one of Talab Vita 37's failsafes. The necrotic texture of the Migu's waxen flesh rippled beneath its many augments, and its head swayed from side to side as it brayed in pain. Tortured beyond endurance by the genetic chaos at work within its body, The creature collapsed, and its riotous anatomy poured from its mouth in a frothed soup of liquefaction. Even as Sharokin watched, devolved portions of its body sought to recombine, healing and degenerating once again in the blink of an eye.
Thrawn,
hissed Tarsa at the sight of the creature's death. The Magos atop the afflicted beast slid from his harness and stepped down to the cavern floor without missing a beat. The tech priest and his entourage of thralls dropped to their knees as he turned to retrieve something from the back of the shuddering corpse. Talab Vita 37's body language instantly changed as the Magos lifted down a heavy-looking case of silver steel. Sharokin thought it an unremarkable object to contain the secrets of life itself.
Magna Mater,
hissed the Gene Witch. Book 3. Crone. Death may be the greatest of all human blessings. Chapter 8. Into them. Iron endures. Active glories. The Magos boarded the transorbital, leaving his dead mount behind. The tempo of operations increased as the mindless thralls began the last preparations for launch. The aircraft's engines pulsed with an increase in power, and the fog of dust and fumes burned off at its rear.
We can't let that ship take off,
said Talab Vita 37.
And do you see any weapons capable of bringing a ship that size down?
Asked Tyro.
Then we need to get on board,
insisted the Gene Witch. We can do that, said Sharokin. Then we fight our way to the cockpit.
How?
Said Tyro.
We don't exactly look as though we belong here.
Sharokin reached down and scooped a handful of pale dust from the floor and smeared it across his armor. He patted a disruptive pattern across the Legion symbol on his shoulder guard. It didn't obscure it, but it would be camouflage enough to get them close to the transorbital before their loyalist provenance became obvious.
Captain Branthon, pick up a pallet crate, said Sharokin. Your scale might fool them into thinking you're a load lifter or bulk servitor. The dust should conceal our insignia until we reach the embarkation ramp. Then we fight our way to the command deck.
I'll not hide the hand of the tenth,
said Newman, watching Sharokin dusting his armor.
If you have another plan, let's hear it, said Sharokin. But we need to move now.
Newman looked at Branthon, who nodded, and reluctantly the veteran began patting his own armor down with dust. He made only a cursory attempt to obscure the mailed hand at his shoulder, and Sharokin didn't ask him to deface his warplate any further. Branthon turned to lift a heavy crate, while the Space Marines finished applying enough dust to obscure their identity. Tyro nodded and said,
Move out. Move confidently. They must think we belong here.
Atesh Tarsa led them from cover. Patched with the pale dust, his green armor most resembled that of the sea green of the Sons of Horus, and, as poor a disguise as it was, it might buy them a few meters. And a few meters could mean the difference between life and death. Sharokin and the Iron Hands kept moving behind Tarsa, and the Raven Guard felt every fiber of his body screaming at being so brazen. To move in the open, directly towards the enemy, was the antithesis of everything he had been taught, and went against every principle by which his legion operated. They moved quickly, pushing out around the edge of the central shaft towards the transorbital. Its engines burned a hot shade of blue, the dust swirling in spiraling thermal vortices. Sharokin walked swiftly, keeping his upper body a quarter turn away from the thralls positioned at the embarkation ramp. His hand rested on the grip of his bolter, out of sight. He glanced behind him, seeing Tyro and Newman looking awkward in the open. So much of the fighting they had done since Istvan had been on the fringes of the war, biting hard and falling back, moving so as not to be seen. This approach bothered them as much as it did him. Branthon lurched behind them, bearing a heavy crate in his outstretched arms. He kept his burden lifted high to better obscure his unnatural body. Sharokin couldn't see Garuda, and just hoped the bird wasn't about to do something inexplicably stupid. He saw the blurred outlines of the thralls turn to face them. Their body language registered no threat. Why would it? Luna was now the dominion of their masters. They had no reason to expect any transhumans who were not Sons of Horus. One of the thralls voiced a blurt of harsh static, a binaric yell to be heard over the growing roar of the engines. The others turned as one, the movement eerily synchronistic. The nearest thrall shouted again, this time with the augmeter implanted in its neck.
"We bring prize to you, masters," it said. "Much speed."
Sharokin willed Tarsa not to answer. 50 meters yet separated them from the transorbital. To be revealed now would leave no time to get aboard before the ramp could be closed. The thrall stepped forward, confused. Its stunted autonomy was slaved to the tech priest already aboard the transorbital. It could make no decision without its master's leave, and the proxy collar it wore winked with light as it sought orders. 40 meters. A shape moved into view at the top of the ramp, a robed figure with glowing augmetic eyes. No amount of dust or fog would fool those optics. The tech priest was sure to see through their primitive camouflage in an instant. 30 meters. Sharokin tightened his grip on the bolter. His armor registered the passage of an energy wave, its machine spirit's hackles raised by an interrogative sweep of an auspex. Immediately the tech priest stiffened, and the ventral lights on the transorbital began flashing as the embarkation ramp began to rise. Sharokin's muscles were already tensed, ready to explode him into action, when a blur of silver shot down through the fog and enveloped the tech priest's head like a gleaming metal mask. Thrashing mechanical wings, razor-edged with flensing blades, sliced flesh and steel with every beat. Garuda's talons were like curved punch daggers, gouging and tearing at the knot of cables rising from the traitorous Martian spine. An arcing spray of jet-black fluid squirted down the embarkation ramp as the cyber eagle's beak ripped out the tech priest's throat. The thralls jerked in empathetic shock, their nervous systems intrinsically linked to the physiology of their master. "Into them!" yelled Sharokin. Tarsa put a mass reactive through the head of the nearest thrall, then switched his aim to the second. Sharokin sped forward, bringing his bolter up to his shoulder and firing a pair of expertly aimed shots that detonated the skulls of the next two thralls. In the face of certain death, the last four thralls threw off the shock trauma of the tech priest's pain and turned to run. Two more bolter shots punched into the closest thralls and burst their unprotected bodies apart from the inside. Sharokin ran for the rising embarkation ramp, his bolter now maglocked to his thigh and a black-bladed gladius in each hand. He launched himself onto the ramp, rolling and slicing low to hack through the spine of the first thrall before spinning around to hurl his second blade. It plunged into the back of the last thrall, buried to the hilt between its shoulder blades. Garuda finished savaging the tech priest's head, its beak and claws wet with black-red fluids that looked nothing like human blood. The bird cawed and launched into the air, flying deeper into the transorbital. "Where are you going?" he yelled after it. But the bird, as always, kept its counsel. Garuda vanished, and Sharokin bent to retrieve his thrown blade. He wiped it clean, looking for the mechanism to reverse the rise of the embarkation ramp, as he felt a lurch in his equilibrium that told him the transorbital had begun to lift from the ground. "Damn it! We're taking off!" A screeching whine of protesting hydraulics made him look back, and he saw Ulrak Branthon holding the ramp in place as the others climbed up. Tarsa, Newman and Tyro were already aboard, and Branthon grunted as he pulled the ramp down enough for him to step onto it. Surprisingly agile for something so large, he all but vaulted into the transorbital as it finally dusted off and the ramp locked into place.
"Move as one," he said,
shucking his arms back to load his underslung storm bolters.
"We take this ship fast."
For so valuable a prize, the transorbital was sparsely crewed. The warriors of the Sisypheum moved through its bare companionways and transits almost without resistance. Thralls and servitors, for the most part, manned its stations. The thralls they killed, the servitors they spared, not for mercy's sake, but so they could continue to fly the transorbital. They found the Magos assigned to the craft, plugged into a console bank, like the grand organ of some theatrical hall. He juddered with traceries of lightning coruscating around his body, as though in the grip of a system-wide seizure. Branthon put him down with a bolt round through his spinal cord, and the juddering stopped. Talab Vita 37 stepped over the body and wrenched all the Magos's mechadendrites and data spikes from the machine. For good measure, she bent and extended a spike of her own from her wrist and rammed it through the fallen Magos's temple.
"He was calling for help," she said.
"Did he succeed?" asked Branthon.
Tyro swept his gaze over the numerous panels and data slates embedded in the console.
I can't say, he replied, but we'll know soon enough if he did.
The silver case the Magos had carried out from the shaft lay next to him, and Talab Vita 37 pulled it close to her, like a mother reunited with her child after a long separation. She slid her still-wet data spike into a slot at its side, and her entire body language changed.
It's safe, she said. They got into the vault, but they didn't try to open the Magna Mater itself. They didn't dare.
Tarsa knelt beside Talab Vita 37, like a knight at the end of his journey before the object of his quest.
Can I see it? He said. We never thought it was real. It was a myth to us.
That is what we wanted you to think,
said Talab Vita 37, pulling the case away from him in an unconscious act of protection.
A power that you could never possess needed to be reduced to allegory, so you would never seek it.
No, I...
What is to stop us taking it now? Said Branthon.
It would do you no good, said Talab Vita 37. It will not open for you, or me, for that matter. Only the High Matriarch can open it.
And the Sons of Horus likely have her, said Branthon.
All the more reason to get this away from Luna, said Tarsa.
All the more reason to destroy it, said Tyro.
Further discussion was halted as the transorbital lurched to the side, and Sharokin felt a ripple of atmospheric change as the lumbering aircraft passed through the integrity field, swiftly followed by the awful sound of steel grinding on rock.
Something's wrong, he said. We need to get to the bridge.
Sharokin set off at a run, following the stenciled markings on the wall that led to the bridge. A ship of war would never provide such markers, but this was a vessel designed simply to ferry cargo between a planet's surface and the orbiting vessels. It wasn't designed for combat, or to be held against a boarding action. Another impact struck the craft, but Sharokin easily compensated. The approach to the bridge was a long, narrow passageway, a sole concession to possible defence. Sharokin and Tyro took up positions on either side.
In all likelihood, the pilots will just be hardwired monotasks, said Talab Vita 37.
We can't take that chance, said Sharokin. For all we know, there might be another Magos in there, or worse, a Sons of Horus legionary.
Or better, you mean, said Tyro.
Sharokin grinned. Or better.
On two,
said Tyro.
One, said Sharokin.
Two,
finished Tyro. And they broke from cover, moving fast, bolters locked on the entrance to the bridge. Branthon filled the corridor behind them, his storm bolters aimed over their heads. The armored door slid open, and Sharokin's finger tensed on the trigger. Nothing came out. No storm of solid rounds or flurry of lasfire. They reached the blast door and swept inside, weapons tracking left and right. Warning lights flashed and proximity alarms blared angrily. Jagged bursts of binaric cant spat from a vox horn dangling from the avionics panel.
Clear,
said Sharokin, and Tyro echoed that confirmation.
Throne,
said Tarsa, entering the wide bridge space and seeing what lay within. As Talab Vita 37 had predicted, the transorbital was crewed by a complement of hardwired monotask servitors, hybrids of men and machine, who never left their seats and only ever fulfilled one function, piloting the ship up and down, over and over, in an endless loop of repetition. A ship this size had a bridge crew of six, and all of them were dead. The canopy and instrument panels were crimson and wet with blood spray. Each pilot's skull had been caved in, the lid of bone peeled back like a ration can in a mess pack, and the organ within pulped and pierced. The tops of their heads were sopping red craters, and every lurching shift of the transorbital's movement spilled tears of pinkish brain matter down their expressionless faces. Garuda perched on the back of the lead pilot's grav seat, grooming itself. Its wings, beak, and claws were wet with blood. Almost no trace of the silver beneath could be seen.
Thrawn, said Tyro. What did you do?
No time for that now, said Sharokin urgently.
What is it?
Said Tyro.
Two things, said Sharokin. One, with the pilots dead, we're going to crash. Two, he pointed through the blood-spattered canopy and said, look. The Chthonian Scion was turning, its black and gold prow angling towards the volcano, like a sword being drawn from its scabbard. A bloom of light, tiny at this distance, detached from its launch bay and streaked across the darkness of the lunar sky.
Thunderhawk, said Tyro. Sons of Horus. The Magos got his warning off, said Sharokin.
Wayland felt the body of the wounded gunship surround him. Its pain was his pain, and it burned through his veins. It bled fire along the fire bundle cables that connected them, racking his body with its many hurts. Part of him wished his body was more augmetic, so as to diminish the agony of the experience. But the greater part of him knew that not sharing the machine's suffering would dishonor its sacrifice. The message from Sharokin had been brief and to the point. Need immediate extraction. Sons of Horus inbound. He'd watched the transorbital rise from the volcano's caldera, then almost immediately sink back down into the volcano. Something was wrong, and no one was responding over the vox. Wayland had plugged straight back into the Storm Eagle's cogitators.
I know you are hurting, and I know I ask too much, but I need you to fly more than ever. Our brothers are in harm's way, and they need us in the air.
He felt the machine's desire, felt the last of its power push back into the steel of its bones.
Yes, yes! Flesh may fail, but iron endures. The machine endures, he said,
knowing the spirit would hear him, if not in words, at least in sentiment.
Where one exists, so too does the other. Where one endures, the other may renew. You are a predator of the iron skies, a hunter of the weak. Your wings are broken, your claws dulled, but you can yet hunt. You can yet kill your enemies.
His words fanned the fire of the Storm Eagle's soul, a burning coal deep in its heart. But still he wondered whether it would be enough. Thematica had worked wonders on the gunship's frame to render it airworthy, but its spirit was all but broken, leaking into the ether with every passing second. Wayland knew machine spirits, had bonded with them and earned their trust. In the ruins of Escalor, he had nurtured the fading embers of a wrecked land raider, its spirit wounded nigh unto death, and driven it straight through the heart of the enemy lines to ultimate victory. That spirit had endured, and it had spoken of Wayland as a friend to machines.
"What say you, brother?" asked Wayland. "One last hunt?"
He felt the Storm Eagle respond, pulsing flows of energy and machine vitality rippling to life around him. Ruptured connections surged with renewed power. The avionics panel flickered, the gem lights blinking in sequence. He eased power through the Storm Eagle's veins, careful not to push too hard, and smiled as the craft lifted from the furrow it had ploughed in the dust. Clouds billowed around it as Wayland teased the gunship back into the air, lifting the nose and pushing power to the engines.
That's it, brother. One final flight together.
When it came, the impact was ferocious. Locked in the death throes of its slain pilots, the transorbital fell 1,500 meters back down into the volcano, a slow-moving wrecking ball with a mass of over 1,000 tons. Dragged down by the internal gravity of the caldera's habitable interior, it rolled with ponderous majesty and slammed against the inside face of the hollowed-out mountain. Its hull buckled, and thousands of liters of fuel-grade promethium gushed out in viscous sheets that fell like iridescent rainbows. Silver-skinned freight containers spilled from its ruptured cargo bays in their hundreds, tumbling like a rain of coins from a dead man's hand. The transorbital rolled onto its side, its drive unit still firing as it ploughed into the towering silos of ancient atomic waste. Irradiated slag from lethally unsafe power plants and dangerous fissile reactions mushroomed into the air and hung suspended between the competing forces of internal gravity and external weightlessness. Blazing wreckage peeled from the falling transorbital as it tore down through the silos to smash back onto the landing platform. The vessel struck hard, its keel splitting with the force of the impact. Its internal spaces folded inwards like crumpled foil as its enormous mass buckled structural stanchions and drove it into the ground. The heat from its drive ignited the aerosolized fuel-air mix, filling the volcano's interior, and transformed its volume into a roiling inferno of atomic flame. A plume of white-hot fire raced up the throat of the volcano and burst from the caldera, as though Herodotus Omega were reclaiming the active glories of its past. Chapter 9. The Mountain Wakes. Erdrakes. They will survive. All Sharokin could see was fire. Orange flames filled the cracked lenses of his helm, and he could feel their heat through rents in his armor. His visor hazed red, crazed with distortion. The internal Auspex was sending him a continuous scream of warning clicks, but with the right lens splintered, he couldn't read what it was telling him. Sharokin pushed himself upright, blinking back the pain from numerous crushed vertebrae and a piercing wound in his side. Blood loss was minimal. His enhanced physiology had seen to that, but his armor could do nothing to keep the pain at bay. He pushed off, trying to find his bearings. The vox screeched static. No one was answering. Red-hued smoke filled the wreckage, and he saw a slumped form crushed against a cogitator panel. Smoke and heat made it impossible to tell who it was. Structural elements, strong enough to survive breaking atmosphere and re-entry, were bent like stalks of corn by the force of the crash. He lurched over to the body, pushing through ropes of hanging cables and sheets of metal flapping like cloth. Cadmus Tyro. It was Cadmus Tyro. Sharokin tried to see exactly how the captain was pinned. To move something wrongly could cause a catastrophic movement of the steelwork and kill Tyro. He was no tech marine, and found it impossible to tell how the interconnected elements of structure were supported. Sharokin knew he didn't have time to be careful. He took his best guess and pushed. Nothing.
Out of the way, Sharokin, said Ulrich Branthon, stepping through the smoke.
Branthon bent his mechanized bulk to the nearest stanchion and braced his shoulder against the metal. Grunting with effort, Branthon pushed, spliced fiber bundle muscles of a dreadnought and pure will against the crushing weight pinning Tyro. The column of steel groaned as it bent upwards, only fractionally, but it was enough. Sharokin dragged Tyro clear, and as soon as the pressure on the captain's chest was eased, Tyro drew in a huge sucking breath. He got his feet under him and stood, taking Sharokin's outstretched hand.
"Is everyone accounted for?"
he asked, his voice little more than a wheeze. "No," said Sharokin. "I haven't seen anyone else." The wreckage around them groaned, heavy beams of structural steel twisting like a wet cloth being wrung out. A billowing wall of flame erupted from somewhere below. A booming string of explosions shook the ruins of the transorbital.
"We have to get out of here, or we'll be buried alive," said Sharokin.
A cascade of debris fell all around them, as if in confirmation. Steel, pipework, cables, and burning insulation material.
"The Magna Mater?"
asked Tyro. "Who knows? If someone didn't get it out, then it's gone." Branthon led the way, with Sharokin and Tyro following in his wake. They weaved a zigzagging path through the wreckage. Passages that ought to have led to evacuation points were choked with debris or fire, forcing them to double back or push through torn bulkheads in search of a way out. The insistent clicking in Sharokin's ear kept getting louder, but he couldn't disable it. Deafening roars of flame and splitting metal filled the crashed transorbital, but Sharokin's senses picked out something rhythmic, something deliberate that didn't fit the chaotic narrative of the ship's death screams.
"Wait,"
he said, halting their progress along a flame-filled companionway.
"Whatever it is, Sharokin, we don't have time to stop,"
said Branthon. Sharokin set off along a buckled transit, the ceiling dripping with globules of ignited fuel like sizzling pearls.
"Come on!"
yelled Sharokin, as the walls bulged inwards with pressure from above. The Iron Hands followed him immediately, trusting his survival instincts to find a way out. Now that he knew what he was listening for, Sharokin could easily pick out the hammering sound. He pushed into a wide gallery that should have been deep in the dorsal section of the ship, but which was now almost open to the outside. Whole decks had been torn away, and Ignatius Newman was busy punching his way through a buckled portion of what was now effectively the outer hull. His helmet had been smashed and lay in splintered pieces at his feet, and even had he not been rendered all but deaf, the roar of flames would have covered their approach. Sharokin approached from the side, letting Newman know he was there with plenty of distance. The veteran looked up, startled. He nodded, checking who was with Sharokin.
"Tarsa? The Gene Witch?"
he asked.
"Unknown,"
said Branthon, pushing through the wreckage to add his own fists to Newman's work. Between them, they soon tore the metal hide of the transorbital apart, and a wave of furnace heat surged inside. Flames from the wrecked vessel's fuel cells reached hundreds of meters into the air, and billowing clouds of tar-black smoke gathered and seethed like an endless storm.
"Go!"
said Branthon, and Newman pushed his way through. Sharokin followed him, then Tyro, and finally Branthon. Visibility was near zero, thanks to the heat and smoke, and even Sharokin struggled to get his bearings. He crouched as low to the ground as he could, scanning for points of reference. Lakes of burning fuel pooled in craters, and a waterfall of flaming promethium spilled into the chasm at the chamber's heart. The heat in the chamber was becoming intolerable, a bone-deep searing pain against which his armor was offering no protection. He could feel his normally ashen skin reacting to the temperature. Oily sweat oozed from his pores to protect him as much as cool him. Sharokin saw the crates and packing materials they had sheltered behind. Miraculously, they remained unscathed, and behind them he saw the way back through the mountain to where the Storm Eagle had gone down. Wayland was savvy enough to know that would need to serve as their extraction point, having surely seen the transorbital crash. "There," he said, springing to his feet. "That's our way out."
"What about the Magna Mater?" said Newman. "Do we have it?"
"Perhaps Taleb Vita 37 has it. Perhaps not. But if it's still on the ship, it won't last much longer," said Tyro. "We may not have it, but at least the traitors won't either. I call that a win for us."
"But the others,"
Newman said.
"We can't leave our brother behind."
"If we go back in there looking for Tarsa, then we all die," said Sharokin.
"No, there must be a way,"
protested Newman.
"Ignatius," said Tyro, firmly but not unkindly. "He's gone."
Ever the pragmatist, Newman nodded, and Sharokin led them through the destruction. Explosions detonated all around them, and rubble fell from above as weakened structures and rock crashed down. Each breath caught in Sharokin's chest, searing and agonizing to take. He felt wet movement in his throat, and knew his lungs and esophagus were adapting to better filter each inhalation. But it didn't seem to be helping. He felt his skin burning beneath his armor, and a deadly caustic lethargy settled within his marrow. He stumbled, but Tyro caught him. Together, they pushed onwards. Sharokin's vision was swimming, and gray, vein-shot clouds seeped into his eyes. He saw movement ahead, a flash of silver, but couldn't be sure it wasn't some trick of the heat or whatever was affecting his vision. Tyro dropped to one knee, his chest heaving with effort. Even Branthon struggled in the smoke and heat, the heart of iron pulsing in his chest as though in distress.
"What's happening?" said Sharokin,
the words slurred and hard to form.
"Fire alone should not affect us this way. It's not just the heat," said Tyro,
hauling him to his feet. They pressed on, and again Sharokin saw the gleam of silver ahead. A mummified figure, bandage-wrapped and with her cloak on fire. The Gene Witch tore the cloak from her shoulders and beckoned them onwards. Limping, battered and weary beyond endurance, the four space marines slumped into the corner of the materiel crates. The intolerable heat dropped fractionally, and smoke peeled from the crates. This cover wouldn't last for long.
"Do you have it?"
asked Taleb Vita 37. They all knew what she meant. Sharokin shook his head.
"No."
Taleb Vita 37's head sank to her chest.
"I failed you, my matriarch,"
she said, talking to someone likely already dead.
"Maybe it is better that it burns," said Sharokin. "You said yourself the Magna Mater was too dangerous to fall into the wrong hands."
"Dangerous or not,"
she said,
"it was the legacy of the Salina, and I swore an oath to keep it safe."
"Better it burns than falls into the hands of traitors," said Tyro.
"Better it burns than any of you claim it,"
spat Taleb Vita 37.
"Loyalist, traitor, foe was right. You are all misbegotten monsters."
"Throne,"
said Ulrak Branthon, pointing back the way they had come. Sharokin turned, and now understood the source of the insistent clicking warnings in his ear. The heat he was feeling wasn't simply from the flames. All but one of the giant silos of ancient radioactive waste were catastrophically ruptured. Cascades of irradiated dust, disintegrated ferrocrete and spent fuel rods were spilling into the chamber and filling the air with enormous quantities of lethally toxic particles and fumes. but it wasn't the ruptured silos to which Branthon was pointing. A lone figure emerged from the flames of the transorbital's wreckage. He waded through the very worst of the radioactive waste, the once jade green of his armour blackened, the metal and ceramite bubbling as it melted. He swayed with every faltering step, dragging the silver case of the Magna Mater. His helmet was gone, and even through the haze of fire, his agony was unmistakable.
Tarsa!
Cried Newman.
The pain was unimaginable. It seared down through his armour, past his flesh and into his very spirit. He could see nothing but flames, but fire held no fear for Atesh Tarsa. He was Nocturne-born, a Promethean sun, raised in the shadow of Mount Deathfire and forged on its basalt slopes. Every step sent shooting spikes of pain up through his pelvis and into his spine. Tarsa could barely remember why he was here, his mind filled with broken glass and the flesh burning off his bones, his skin crisped and roasted in the heat, flaking from the thinnest portions of his skull. One step, then another. Keep going. Head down into the flames. Fire roared across the red earth, scorching the surface of the mountain. He looked up, seeing the slopes of Mount Deathfire belching smoke and flame. Through all the agony racking his body, Tarsa smiled. He had long given up any hope of seeing Nocturne again. Yet here it was, welcoming him home as a true son of Vulcan. A burning sun glared down, and Tarsa gasped as he saw the silhouette of an eagle sweep across it. Its wings were golden in the firelight. Tarsa had never seen anything quite as beautiful. A silver case, heavy beyond what its appearance would suggest, dragged behind him, but he no longer knew what it was. All he knew was that it had been entrusted to him, and that he must bear it to safety. But it was too heavy a burden. Too much for any warrior to bear. Who could ask such a thing of him? But the duty of every salamander was to bear the burdens others could not. To stand where others fell. To march into the fire when others turned their backs. All sense of the world around him was consumed in fire and smoke. The darkness of his skin peeled back, flesh flying in the hellstorm surrounding him like cinders stamped from a hearth. Yet still he marched. Nothing would stop him. Nothing could. He staggered, a vortex of superheated air threatening to drive him to his knees. He wouldn't let it. Another step through the fire that was killing him, with every poisoned breath. Onwards into the flames and searing atomic haze he walked. The eagle flew with him every step of the way as the sky burned and the ground ran molten. His every step across the mountain's haunches was a homecoming, and he welcomed it, wishing he could have gazed upon the face of his Primarch one last time. His foot slipped, and Tarsa dropped to one knee. He tried to rise, but the strength had fled from his body. How easy it would be to simply lie down and die. But that was not the way of the salamanders. They lived for the fire, relished the challenge of facing it every day. To be burned was to know you were alive. He heard the eagle's cry, and with a roar of defiance, Tarsa rose to his feet, his body all but flayed alive by the atomic fury raging around him. He took another step. Two more. He slipped again. And this time, there would be no getting up. But he did not fall. A giant in burning armor was there to catch him.
"I've got you, brother," he said.
Tarsa looked up into a face as midnight black as his own, the face of a salamander. But no ordinary salamander. This was the face of a demigod. Haloed by fire and the black slopes of the mountain that forged him, with a smiting hammer in one hand, a blade in the other.
My lord, said Tarsa, you live.
Aye, Tarsa, I live. Said Primarch Vulcan.
I saw you,
gasped Tarsa, desperate to pass on these last words.
On Terra, dead. but I held true. I knew. Vulcan lives. I knew you would never leave your sons.
I leave no one behind, said Vulcan.
Tarsa nodded and tried to turn, to pass his burden on, but he had no more strength to give. Vulcan reached over him and hefted the silver case as though it weighed nothing at all. He was a Primarch, after all, one of the Emperor's favored sons.
I tried, my lord,
said Tarsa, the last embers of his soul dimming.
I tried to prove worthy of you.
Vulcan nodded and said,
You asked me once if I trusted you. Do you remember?
Tarsa could not, but he nodded. Anything for his gene sire.
I said, you come from a land of fire. You lived in the light of burning mountains. I trust. Do you remember that?
A memory surfaced. A brutish giant, knee-deep in corpses.